time to go out and... Time to go out in the garden and do some watering and do some grass cutting and to transplant some stuff out of the greenhouse into the ground and weed a little bit. And that's what it's been a good day for here in Sebastopol, California. Taking time to breathe today. And boy, that's kind of the only thing kind of keeping me tethered, because it's been an amazing week, and I've really been looking forward to coming back to you guys tonight on the Lifeboat Hour here on PRN-FM. Peter Joseph is on the line. I'm going to have him on. I had the most amazing conversation with him this week. It just lifted my spirits amazingly. But I got to rant a little bit first. I mean, I drove down to L.A. on Monday, and the cheapest gas that I found along the way was $4.30 a gallon. I found some at $4.90. And I got down there, and of course I did Joe Rogan on Tuesday, and Joe is just an amazing guy, and boy, he's good for me, because he lets you bring every part of yourself onto the show. You don't have to package up your intellectual side and leave the sense of humor at home, or leave the sexuality, or leave the off color, or leave the, you know, the anger. Joe wants you to bring all of you to the show, and I do that. I had a great time with Joe Rogan, although his conversations, man, they change direction. They make a U-turn at 160 miles an hour. I got to wear a football helmet next time I go down there. But it was fun. It was a really good time seeing Joe again and hanging out. And I got to see a lot of other people in L.A., and I got to spend three good days down there. And but the undeniably the best part of the trip, I think, was a great dinner I had with Peter Joseph and Shar Zeitgeist, who is like this amazing linchpin of the Zeitgeist movement, and my dear friend Alan Routbord. We all had a dinner, and that was the payoff for the trip for me. But you know, and before I set up what set all this loose, let me just give you an update out there on what's happening in the world. Okay, now pay close attention. We've had major earthquakes over the weekend in Italy, Japan, and New Zealand. There's a volcano that's blown up in Guatemala, spewing hot lava. Greece is exiting the euro, soon to be in complete collapse. And for all you people who just didn't think it was happening until a country was fully dead, well, Greece may well be fully dead by next week or the week after. The government may just collapse completely with no cash, no nothing. And so there you'll have your first proof for those of you who thought Greece was still functional and that allowed you to live in denial. But, of course, bank runs are underway all over Europe as we speak. You know, the EU is dead. 20,000 people marched in Frankfurt yesterday to protest economic corruption. That's 20,000. We had today and yesterday major violence in Chicago over NATO. There was a bombing at a high school in Italy, killed some high school students. Delhi, India is experiencing massive power outages. They're throwing Molotov cocktails in Montreal. And a massive Arctic melt of tundra is releasing huge quantities of ancient methane into the atmosphere in columns that are a kilometer or more across 10-15. I mean, NATO is doing anything it can to try to get out of Afghanistan and to keep from breaking up at the same time. And I'm kind of voting that NATO's going to break up over this, because Europe ain't got any more money. There's been a new crack found in the south wall of Fukushima's number 4 reactor. That's the wall right underneath 1,500 spent fuel rods, which, if that building falls over, is a total threat to the existence of all life on this planet, containing about 80, 85 times more radiation than anything that's ever been released, and it would result in open-air fission reaction that really has never been experienced before. And the G8, minus Russia, is asserting now in today's stories that they have everything under control, and they are supremely confident that they can really get some solid growth going in Europe and save Greece and the EU. Okay, now, and on top of this, the world's electronic waste is ending up in China. Get this, there's a story on collapse, and it's not we anymore. 5 million TV sets, 4 million refrigerators, 5 million washing machines, and 5 million PCs, along with 10 million mobile phones, are dumped in China every year. Okay, so if you have the courage to face this stuff and you want to know, because now is the time when collapse net is just exactly what you need, because now is the time when you're going to get warnings about what's coming at you and how fast. And that's what CollapseNet is there for. And I have been very happily out of CollapseNet for a week, and Wes Miller and his team are just kicking ass. They're doing great. Wes has written a really good story that's up there on CollapseNet, and the World News Desk just continues to tell you the things you need to know, whether you want to know them or not. But at some point in time, you're going to realize that it might behoove you to pay attention to what's going on in the world. That being said, I'm down in L.A., and I got to see some old friends, and it was really good. I got to bring some presents to some people and connect. I was eager to get back home here, but I had a great time. But then on Thursday night, we went to Rush Street, which is my favorite restaurant in Culver City. I heartily recommend it. And Peter Joseph joined us, and we're sitting across from each other. And I know how I'm feeling. I'm feeling tired. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling everything. And I just looked across at Peter Joseph, founder of the Zeitgeist Movement. He's a director. He's a musician. You all know who he is. But he's also just one of the most intellectually brave men I've ever known. And I looked across the table at Peter, and I said, Spirit spoke to me. And Spirit said, they've had all the warnings they're going to get. And he just broke out into this huge grin. It's like, yeah. And as I'm pulling around here, trying to figure out the shape of this book that I'm going to write now, I had contact with Dmitry Orlov this week, who has also had like the same kind of epiphany. It's like we've all reached a breaking point at once. Dmitry's going to be writing another book, and it's very clear that there's been a major shift. So we're all kind of realigning. But what a relief it was to look at Peter Joseph and just see that big grin break out on his face, because I think we both felt the same sense of relief. Peter Joseph, welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour, man.
Hey, Mike. It's my pleasure to be here, and thank you for the introduction. And yeah, man, I think we're plowing against a brick wall here. It's pretty easy to get exhausted. I think we both share a unique history. Grant, you've been going at this a whole lot longer than I have. I'm half your age, and how you've had the fortitude and stamina to keep forward, I have no idea. Nevertheless, you know, we keep moving forward, but there's got to be a point where people need to start to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a kind of a leadership complex. I'm sure you've had this come your way as well over the years, and I've been getting to the stage after dozens and dozens of lectures and traveling the globe that if people don't step up and begin to take the reins, you know, we're going to have a kind of a grim future out there if people don't begin to realize their personal responsibility. And the one thing I will comment on regarding that conversation we had, which I really appreciated, was when you said, yeah, most people, they just want to know how it affects them mm-hmm. in the immediate sense. And unfortunately, that is no way to live. If you can't step outside and be empathetic to the world around you and get the heebie-jeebies and you see the Fukushima power plant about to destroy humanity, if you can't feel that way, then there's something wrong with you. I'm hoping that we can get at least that across the course of time.
What's also a relief, I'm sure you've had this experience, because we also shared about how we have been needled and poked by vampires and government operatives and all the people who just don't want people to hear what we say. And we've all had the experience that somebody says something that really gets under your skin, and about 6 weeks later you think of the perfect answer, the perfect response. And one of the ones that I had that I shared with you was like, I was so tired of people asking me how long before it happens. And what I realized, and I didn't have this answer until I'm sitting across from you, is that all these people are is selfish, self-centered people, and they're not really asking how long before it, whatever it is, happens. What they're really asking is how long before it makes me uncomfortable.
That's right. And, that narrow self-interest.
And with that comes the absolute implicit statement that I don't give a crap what happens to anybody else in the world. I don't care if there's a billion people starving worldwide. I don't care that there's riots all over the world. I don't care that there's, six suicides a week in Greece, 7. I don't care that, the lights are going out and people are homeless and starving and there's disease. All I want to know is, when's it going to affect me?
And that's right.
That condition of selfishness and self-centeredness one of the best lines I ever heard from a spiritual teacher. You'll love this, Peter. This was some time ago, but this guy calls me over and he says, "Hey, Mike, there are 6 billion people in the world, and right now, not one of them is thinking about you. Have a good day." And, but the problem with the level of consciousness extant at this stage of human industrial civilization is that it's not the problem that people think highly of themselves or lowly of themselves. It's that people think constantly of themselves. And
right.
The work and the work that you and I do and so many others have done, and I have to salute this, requires enormous intellectual courage, emotional courage, and spiritual courage. And I'm sure I can speak for you and say we didn't go into this business because we thought it would be fun and we could make a lot of money. We did this because we felt an obligation to be of service.
Well, you know, the sense of your place in this life, you know, what does it mean? It's really a symbiotic relationship, is it not? And that's something that's just long lost. You know, you mentioned the word spiritual. That means connectedness, ultimately. It's like, what is our place? What are we doing here? Mm-hmm. What's the point of this? You know, how do we properly engage the environment that basically created us? And that's what's been so lost over the years. And you have this self-indulgent culture. You have this idiotic economic system that reinforces the absolute worst possible behaviors and values of the human species. So it doesn't really surprise me that people think this way. It's just, what is it going to take? What's it going to take for people to finally wake up and realize that their self-interest really, really must become social interest in the broad scheme?
Absolutely.
If we expect to survive, you know?
We have an early caller. I'll get him on now. I would encourage you to hold your calls until after the bottom of the hour. I'll call for them. But Jared from Oregon's on the line. Jared? No, he's disconnected. Okay, all right, we missed him. All right, let's run with that for a second, Peter, because I have heroes. I have the ones who came before me, you know, who set examples. That would be M. King Hubbard.
Right.
That would be Gary Webb. Well, no, actually, I was on the CIA case, but you know, there are so many people. Colin Campbell, Matt Simmons. There were so many people out here talking about this for so long, and I kind of took my cue from them, and I saw them never give up. And that was the kind of example I led. But I think, from my observation, and I truly respect your intelligence. You don't miss much. And that's why a good conversation with you is a steak dinner. But I've gotten the sense from everyone who has inspired me that we did this because it was like in our DNA.
Sure, sure. Well, we just recognize that this is really where the meaning rests. I mean, again, people can collect this stupid, you know, property, and they can get their money in their bank accounts and produce their family but where does the real meaning lie? What is the success of us? What does it mean to be successful? It's not obviously how much money you have in your bank account. It's how you relate to your environment, how you properly think about your basically subservience to the world around you. In other words, you know, the concept of nature is so underplayed. Everyone wants to be free. We hear this buzzword all the time. No one's free. We're completely bound by these laws around us. We're bound by peak oil. We're bound by everything that defines the environment that we've gained sustenance from. And it continues to perturb me that you have this convoluted notion. I see all the presidential candidates, and I go across the world, and you see this rhetoric, this mind-numbing rhetoric of freedom, when the exact opposite concept needs to be put forward for the species to really understand its place.
Well, yeah.
Symbiosis. And that's really the core of the Zeitgeist Movement, just to plug that. That's really what the Zeitgeist Movement's about. People, as they contact you, they say, well, when is the collapse going to happen? Well, it's obviously already been happening for a very long time. If you can't see that, it's mind-blowing. Drop yourself in the middle of Africa and you'll understand what collapse means. But, you know, people don't seem to understand that their relationship is the most critical point, and that's a shift of consciousness, which is also something we talked about.
There's that C word, consciousness.
Yeah, right.
And that is so important. And in a certain sense, on the one hand, I can sit back and say that my struggles for 30 years have been Sisyphean, and that all I was trying to do was to get people to see that CIA was bringing drugs into the country, and then, you know, became this bigger thing.
Right.
But we face these challenges, and yet we have persevered for so long. And I'll take credit for my longevity here and all the witness I have. I have to salute you because you have one of the finest minds I've ever met in my whole life. You get the way money works better than anybody, except for me, maybe. But
boy, I appreciate that.
But you see it full on with both eyes, and you see it with your heart. And when you see the evil with your heart, that's a good setup for our song. We are in a nightclub here, so we have to do a song here, Peter.
That's right.
And you're a musician, and so am I. And God, we love music. How much has music saved you from going absolutely batshit crazy?
I know, absolutely.
I picked out a special song tonight from New White Trash. We haven't played this actually in quite a while. I sing one word in this song. Work is the word. But this was after I'd gotten co-writing credits on a couple songs, and I'm really in a groove with the band. And we had Kristen Weygaard, who was just an amazing singer, and she humbled me. Because I had been, like, infusing the group with all my ideas, teaching them about what's going on in the world. And Doug Lewis had taken my ideas and penciled out some lyrics, but some ideas. But I sat in the studio as Kristen Weygaard pulled this whole song off the top of her head in just three takes.
Nice.
The song is called Don't Dig Too Deep, and boy, does that apply to you and me, because we've been digging deep for a long time, and we've been taking it for it. And here's Kristen Weygaard with a message for everybody, because only the brave want to do something like this. Kristen Weygaard. Kristen Vigard from New White Trash. This song is Don't Dig Too Deep, one of 37 originals we have at newwhitetrash.com. A lot of those songs have to do with what's going on in the world right now. Our guest is Peter Joseph. I don't know where it's coming from, but if you're hearing any heavy breathing on the air, it's not me. It's the ghost. It's the specter of collapse coming in. Yes, just lingering right behind our neck. Yes, don't dig too deep. No, just think positive thoughts. Everything will be better. Peter, we were. I'm going to get to what you're doing and all that, but there were several great themes we hit during that conversation. One, there was another great smile that I evoked out of you, which just made me really happy when I declared to you that I have become an Orwellian reductionist. I am absolutely convinced that for 5,000 years or so, human beings have been farmed like cattle. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that stands to all reason. I think people have such a loss of history. They don't seem to understand how long the game of controlling the masses has been going on. And there's nothing special about that. You know, if you go back, for example, to Hitler, of course, he has this thing called divide and conquer. You can go to archive.org and watch this propaganda piece made called Divide and Conquer, which was an internal piece made by the Nazi regime about how to control people. And it isn't some far-fetched thing to realize that most of society has been treated like cattle. And as we pointed out in that conversation, the fractional reserve lending system, you put people into a position of servitude in a pyramid structure, and then all of that money that's funded by the energy and labor of the lower end of that pyramid just goes right up for a huge multiplier to the upper 1%, as it's now being called in the Occupy movement. So if people don't realize that, then they're really not paying attention to history, you know?
Well, because they don't want to, and because they have successfully or sleepily, druggedly bought the perception that they are free when they are not.
True.
Most people wouldn't recognize freedom if it bit them on the butt. But given that, and I'm going to plant this thought before we go to break here in about 3 minutes. As we went deeper into the conversation, and this is what I'm wrestling with as I try to structure my new book. By the way, I'm not writing the book for posterity. I'm writing the book because I have a great quote on a quilt on my bed. Born to blush unseen, except by the angel. Spirit will know what I write, and it's between me and spirit what I write in there. And there's a freedom in that. I don't have to kiss anybody's butt anymore. But as I think this out, we talked about how M. King Hubbard, in his early papers, and I quoted this in my second book, Confronting Collapse, had the direct connection between energy and money. He had it very clearly in his work. And I came across it independently, but I was really gratified to see that we'd reached the same conclusion. And he tracked this lock on the consciousness of humankind back to the origins of money, which he quoted as from folkways of prehistoric origin. In other words, it's something older and darker than prehistory, and I don't believe that there's only 5,000 years of world history. I believe there's maybe 10, 15, 20,000 years of world history that the rest has just been hidden. But what I conclude from that, and this is also something that I conclude, because you and I, Peter, cannot sit back and say that the leaders of the world, whether it's Barack Obama or the government or G8 or whoever the hell it is, are not aware of what they are doing. They are aware. They have to be aware. Their scientists are telling them about climate collapse. They know there's not going to be any more growth. They know how much oil it is, and yet they're still doing what they do. And I came up with this with a conclusion that there has been a continuous, unbroken chain of custody, evil control. I guess that's my line. I'm sorry. Of the planet. In other words, there has been a class, a cadre, some group of people who have done and possessed this knowledge and this control uninterrupted. We're coming right up on break. Let me just plant that thought. You'll have the floor, Peter, when we come back. And if you'd like to ask Peter Joseph of the Zeitgeist Movement any questions tonight or me, You can call in after the break at 1-888-874-4888, or you can email us directly at thelifeboathour@collapsenet.com. This is Mike Rupert on the Lifeboat Hour at PRN FM. We are growing like maniacs, and that's because some people are kind of realizing they've been fed a lot of junk food. We'll be right back after this message. That's one of my favorites out of New White Trash. You can find those all at newwhitetrash.com. Our guest tonight on the Lifeboat Hour is the indefatigable Peter Joseph of the Zeitgeist Movement, who I really enjoyed his smiling, laughing face and a little frivolity. But you know what? It's probably time for frivolity now. Peter, we have a caller on the line. We're going to bring him on, but then you can pick up with that thought that I left us with right before we went to break. Jim from Syracuse, are you there?
Yeah, I'm Mike. I have a question for your guest. I watched this movie, though it was great, but I'm trying to get some fact-finding regarding Hercules and Murtha of Persia, and I can't seem to find it anywhere.
Hercules? Did you say Hercules?
Yeah.
Are you referring to the first film doesn't even really address Hercules, first of all. And as far as anything to be sourced in my first film, you can find it in the companion guide that was created. It's about 220 pages. It sources every sentence. You can go to zeitgeistmovie.com and find that. But Hercules actually isn't a focal point at all.
Well, Murtha of Persia and some other people who had the same story as Jesus. It's like, you know, I've spoken to a few people about that, how arguments would, you know, prove it. And I can't find any facts.
Well, then you go to the source guide, and you'll find tons and tons, thousands of sources are there. So thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing I'm not going to miss, you know. I had to live – I'm sorry, Peter, I cut you off because I'm going to give you the thought. But it's like I had to spend my whole life, like 30-some years, footnoting when I wiped my butt. Footnoting when I brushed my teeth, and people look for one footnote, and nobody's ever challenged any of my footnotes, not even the thousand in Rubicon, you know. But it's there is enormous freedom in just being able to speak an obvious, clear truth without needing a footnote. I'm sorry, Peter, go ahead with all that dark stuff we were talking about before the break.
Oh, sure, yeah. I just comment that most of the time people just simply don't know where to look to find the information that's presented in some of these works, which is why, again, I make companion guides for all of my films. But, yeah, back to the point you made. In fact, I'd written down some notes. You brought up M. King Hubbard, and I think it's really important that everyone listen that hears this name follow up and research Mr. Hubbard because of his tremendous contribution and his work with the technocrats, which technocrats today is given a bad name. You know, people always refer to the technocrats as some overarching thing. But actually, the original technocrats were a group of people that wanted to incorporate science into the social system. And then Hubbard wanted to have energy credits. And that goes back to the link of money.
Yes, yes.
And that's a really brilliant concept. It's difficult to argue the way he was attempting to assess it. But I do, you know, people like Buckminster Fuller, Jacques Fresco, they get a lot of their data sets from the technocrats.
So well, we have some calls stacking up. You're a popular guy. Peter,
let me comment real quickly on the evil issue that you mentioned. One thing the people that are in power know that what they do has very limited functionality and it serves their purposes over everyone else. But they justify it. This is something that I think a lot of people miss. They justify it as actually a positive in their mind because of how ingrained their elitism is. If you understand that mentality, you begin to see through and understand the humanity of these people. You know, if you sat down and spoke with, you know, just the worst of the worst, like Zbigniew Brzezinski, if you sat down and spoke with the man, you probably appreciate his candor and rhetoric because he really does believe what he talks about.
And he's very intelligent. He's very articulate.
Oh, yes. But it's his values that are disturbed. It's his, it's the educational platform that he was brought into and indoctrinated into, almost kind of like a secret society, as they're called, where values are implanted and everyone operates kind of robotically based on those values. So that's what I really wanted to touch upon, because you have like the Alex Jones types that kind of dismiss these people. They think they should be hung up and crucified, and there's a lack of understanding of what makes a monster. You know what I mean? These people are groomed into their positions.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote, and I read Solzhenitsyn because I feel like I've spent most of my life in a gulag of sorts. We have three calls, so we're going to go to Peter from Texas next. But Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote that men, in order to do evil, must first believe that what they are doing is good.
Right.
There. And so there, you really kind of touch on something important. But let's get to some of these callers. Peter from Texas, are you there? Peter? Peter from Texas, do we still have you? If not, we will go.
Can you hear me now?
Ah.
Michael. Michael and Peter, you guys are modern-day heroes, in my opinion. I love what you do. Keep doing it. I'm actually the Texas coordinator for the Zeitgeist Movement down here, and I had a quick question for Peter. With the NATO summit going on, is there one presentation or a particular message you love to give to them if you had an opportunity to speak to them up there at the NATO summit?
Well, you want to talk about banging your head against a brick wall. I probably wouldn't even attempt such a thing. I think, you know, the data that we describe with respect to what NATO's responding to with these various crises across the world needs to be presented and understood by the population and the governments, so something like NATO really can be dismantled, to be perfectly frank, because it's only serving negative roles as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Let's go to Janet from Lake Orion. Janet, are you there?
Hi. I was wondering, how is the Global Redesign Institute project coming along?
Oh, thank you for asking. Mike, if I mentioned that to you, but we have a project that's developing slowly. It's called the Global Redesign Institute, and basically what this is going to be an open-source platform digitally for people to begin to think about the reconstruction after this breakdown that we talked about, and to be able to show the public in their regions what's possible technically, not with money, not with debt, but what's possible based on the scientific awareness we have today. So, for example, we could have people redesign all of Los Angeles, and they would take a layout of Los Angeles, look at the resources, look at where the best supply of desalination could come in, where we put vertical farm systems to provide food for the people using aeroponics and hydroponics, all advanced technology. That's going to be a wonderful project and kind of the forefront, really, of the Zeitgeist movement when we begin it, because of how critically relevant such intellectual reflection is. As far as how it's going, I'm currently in the midst of helping out with a nonprofit that's going to be based around this, and then we're going to start to establish chapter segments that will begin to engage this, basically giving each region a palette of their choice to start their own logical redesign of their region, if that makes sense. But I'm sorry to say we're still not there yet, and my time has been so inhibited by other factors that it's going to be a number of months before we get that off the ground. But it should be very exciting.
Now, sitting back as I am with like the big picture that I've had from CollapseNet and my longevity of this, I thought, as you were describing that, I thought, man, that if you had that all set up, that could plug like into Transition US in a heartbeat. It's like the pieces are laying around all over the place. But what is missing is the consciousness that provides the willingness to do the work.
Absolutely. To finish that point, if you showed the world what's possible and they really understood it, because, you know, everyone thinks it's sci-fi to, you know, have... to be off the grid. I mean, no one thinks about it because, for one, no one can afford it. And so the monetary inhibition is so strong that people just have a complete loss of what's possible. And money doesn't have to be used to make the world into an efficient, sustainable place.
Money is like an irrelevancy or a distraction, even.
Precisely. It completely inhibits. It messes everything up. We can't get anything done as we're watching across the world, as we're being strangled by debt. So it could be an amazing project, absolutely, for Transition.
We have we have another caller, Bakari from New York. Are you there?
Hey, how you doing? This is Bakari.
I'm the coordinator for Georgia chapter Zeitgeist Movement. So I sort of wanted to ask a question regarding Zeitgeist Movement, the Zeitgeist moving forward. One of the quotes that you had inside of there, Mr. Rupert, you said that capitalism, socialism, and communism were created by writers who assumed we lived on a planet with infinite resources. And I wanted to know if it would be possible for you to expand on that a little bit, and also how you see the movement as finding itself outside of that.
Did you get that, Mike?
Yeah, I certainly did. I mean, it's like we've all arrived at the same truth. I used that line in the movie too. You take it first.
Well, the question I think was the line that you had regarding. Do you remember that line that you said where you described how socialism, communism, and capitalism are all based on the assumption of infinite resources?
Yeah,
great point.
They're all outdated, outgrown, irrelevant, you know, anachronisms.
Right. I mean, it's unique to me that people in positions of supposed control are not referencing anything physical. I mean, that's when you deal in the fantasy of money, everything becomes a metaphysic. It's like the stock market. The stock market shouldn't exist at all, but yet it still has this weird power on the movement of human society and investment and all of that strange fantasy. And that's, again, is at any point to drill into anybody, it's that we live in a physical world, and money is a complete detachment. It's decoupled. It's denatured. It's denaturing us.
As Charles Eisenstein wrote that so brilliantly in Sacred Economics about how money is an unnatural god. It is separated from physical reality, but yet when the markets fail or debt overtakes or a banking collapse, all because of criminal behavior, it feels as if God is abandoning the world. And there is a perverse spiritual quality to money and infinite growth.
Absolutely. And back to the consciousness, the values are so polluted out there. It's like people don't know what to think anymore. They're so lost in the world of the monetary fantasy. It's really frustrating. We've come so far from the simple Native American ideas, you know, where you don't pee in the stream that you drink from. I mean, we can't even get that right, you know?
Yeah.
We can't even get that right.
That's sacred, yes.
Yes.
But, you know, that comes back to another point that is really becoming paramount. It's like I never pick anything easier, right? Let me put it this way. The universe never picks anything easy for me to write about. But there is a true and distinct quality of evil to all this, which is a self-aware evil that can be described really in no other way, because there is full awareness on the part of the people running this world, or who think they run this world. I call them the powers that were now, of what they're doing, and yet there is some reason, there is something that makes them hold on beyond any sense for the rational continuation of what they're doing. I almost threw up today when I was reading four headline stories about how Barack Obama and the G8 are confident they can bring growth back to Europe. I mean,
it's incredible, isn't it? It's throwing oil on a gasoline fire. They have no idea. And as you point out, though, they have to know. They have to know.
Yeah.
But this is the illusion that's been set up. So they advertise this reality for the public to keep them docile for as long as they can. And I have no idea what they're going to do. I mean, where do you think these people are going to go? I know that we have a lot of wealthy people building islands remotely, you know, in the middle of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We have a huge criminal meltdown of these banks and government institutions, not as much government, but government-related, working with their confluence to get as much money, and everyone's scrounging for as much as possible right now. And I just wonder, at what point are they going to realize the futility of their actions, you know?
I hope they're conscious and alive, and I hope we get to see it when they do.
Right.
You know, that's the other thing on my path, because anyone who is as meticulous as you are, as King Hubbard was, as Colin Campbell was, Richard Hindberg, all of us are faced with a challenge in our writing as journalists, because I know the deep sense of integrity that you feel with your work, as do I, in our obligation to, as professionally as possible, filter out ego-centered observations or motives for interpretation. That's what requires enormous intellectual courage, I think, because it also requires very deep personal self-examination on the part of the writer or the presenter, and you must anguish over every word that you put out as much as I have through two books and the movie and, you know, everything else.
Absolutely. I can completely understand that. You know, the tricky thing with the culture that we both and all of us have been born into is, where do you put your emphasis? Do you put your emphasis on your own narrow self-interest, or do you try as hard as you can to expand that, remove the ego, and to really begin to appreciate the symbiotic relationship you have to nature, which to me, again, is the definition of spirituality. And that is what comes to me, the worst thing to me about the system is that it reinforces the former. It's constantly pushing the narrow self-interest. It's constantly pushing the ego identification. Mm-hmm. It's constantly reinforcing the worst thing. And the most benign argument is they say, oh, well, that's just human nature. Human nature is many different things. But one of the things it can be, if you live in a world of scarcity, if you live in a world supporting ego and selfishness, then yes, human nature can be this hard, you know, bastardized existence where everyone, no one cares about each other, there's no empathy.
Yeah.
But on the other side, we have plenty of examples, and I want to make sure this point is understood by people too. We have plenty of examples through history where people have learned to work together and learned to share their resources and learned to put their minds together for the greater good, and there's nothing wrong with that. And it would seem to me that our entire evolutionary stability is based upon this shift of consciousness. You know, one funny example I used because of, I used to be into this guy, Edward O. Wilson, who's a very famous microbiologist. He also did a lot of things I didn't care for, but he used to research ants. Ants are the oldest species on the planet. You know why? They're social. Ants have the longest longevity of any other species. You can go back and find strains of ants that go way past the dinosaurs. That's how efficient they were. Why? Because they have no self-interest. So keep that mind out there.
And termites build structures that are by scale like 20 times larger than the tallest building humans have ever built.
Right.
You know, and yeah, so there is like what I'm also extremely offended by, and I've had just enough of in my life, is being forced to carve myself up into little pieces whenever I am either going to speak or write or do the radio show. You know, put your sense of humor aside, put your passion aside, just be the, you know, do this or that. And we have been, Henry Miller, who was one of the most brilliant writers and most courageous writers, I think, of all time, intellectually especially, had this phrase called the fragmentation of maturity. And what a brilliant phrase that is. And I, for one, and I kind of got that sense from Dimitri. We're going to have him on when he gets gets deeper into his new book. But I wonder if you share that I'm just tired of having to leave parts of me in other places because I have to perform.
Well, I can completely identify with that. I've given more lectures the past 18 months than ever, and this is coming from a really introspective kid who never, apart from doing some music performances, never gave, you know, speeches.
Right.
And it's by far the most grueling thing I've ever engaged.
Yes.
There's so much heart and suffering that goes into the development of such a personal execution for a talk like that. Like that one lecture I did recently in Israel, that thing took me forever.
I was going to go there. That was you were, you know, I almost said, oh my God, you fool, but you went and you did something that I thought was just, to tell us about Israel.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to really be kind of a tourist there, but I did get to talk to all the people that were related to Zeitgeist and get a sense of the area. You know, as far as the talk itself and the community, I was really happy to see both, you know, Israelis and Palestinians represented in the audience. I got to talk to many, many different people. In fact, when I travel anywhere, all I do is talk. My mouth opens and suddenly I'm just a conversation piece for the next 4 days. But the entire impression of Israel is really a great, it's one of the most backwards places, and it's an amalgam of almost everything that's kind of wrong with the value systems that are happening across the world. Now, you can go a little bit farther to say Saudi Arabia and get really, really despotic with the sense of isolation, value isolation. But it was unique to see how smart these people were and how enclosed and imprisoned they really were by the institution that they were born into. You know, it's really sad, frankly.
I've never been to Israel, but that's the deep sense I've gotten from talking to Israelis and having corresponded with some, and of course read many, many news stories about the situation there. But there's many places. What I see happening globally in every nation in the world is that everyone is being trapped by all of their bad assumptions now.
Right.
Which leads me to, and we've got about 8 minutes left, and maybe we can go here a little bit before the end of the show. Which brings me to something else that I'm weaving into my book. I spent 21 years in 12-step recovery, which is going to be a whole separate enchilada to cover when I write the book. But the premise of that is that the first step before a major change in consciousness can take place, before spiritual power, which I liken to electricity, it's generic. It has nothing to do with religion. Spiritual power exists, and it has been proven. But the first step is complete deflation. It is a state of complete hopelessness when people have run out of answers, that they become beaten, if you will, into a state of reasonableness. And that right now, as far as I'm concerned, as I look at the world objectively, Peter, is about the only thing that can save us right now, is some kind of miraculous change in consciousness and the intervention or the presence of forces unseen or unknown.
Right. Well, as we've talked about before, it's one of two things, either or in combination. It's either that we have this ongoing collapse and finally people are so inconvenienced and disillusioned with the political system that they begin to demand something new, which, you know, seems logical enough as biosocial pressures, as they're called. But then simultaneously, you really hope we don't have to go that far. You really hope that people can wake up fast enough and begin to rattle the cage a bit and stop what is really this annihilation, this slow motion annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
We have an exponential increasing. I mean, what's it going to take? You know, we have over a billion people starving to death. One person dies every 5 seconds. And what's happened when we had 2 billion people starving? Are people going to still be as complacent? What happens when we have 3 billion people starving? Because it's inevitable. There's no way that the system can correct itself within the current model. And how much suffering and misery and homeless people and foreclosures and people's suicides can we possibly take as a culture with this sick structural violence before we will step up and get some empathy and want to do something different? Not to mention the positives. I mean, there's so much, such great possibility for us, the abundance we could create, the balance, just ingenuity, the real freedom we could generate. It's amazing to see the possibility. And frankly, that's more frustrating for me. I know me, along with many other Zeitgeisters, we're more frustrated by what's possible than what we're enduring now, because it's so unnecessary what's happening across the world.
Yes.
You know, it's sad.
Looking at it from the standpoint of 12-step and recovery, whether you're dealing with an alcoholic, an addict, a gambler, any of the addictive type behaviors, food, anything else, what has become common in the, you know, 50, 60, no, 1933, it's a long time, 80 years since 12-step came along, was the concept of intervention, which therapists liken to raising the bottom. And that's really what the idea is. You try to raise the bottom so that people reach an awareness of the hopelessness of their condition before they die or before families are totally destroyed. And in a sense, what the people like you and I and Colin Campbell and Rich Heinberg and Jim Kunstler, you know, all of us have been doing is trying to do an intervention on a society, a human consciousness that doesn't want to admit that it has a problem.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great way to phrase it, a global intervention, a cultural intervention, absolutely.
You know, but there comes a point, and I had this experience on many occasions, you know, where you realize that you have to cut your losses. And this is kind of the point where I kind of felt that you were at and I was at, and I feel Dimitri's at. I think we've all crossed that Rubicon, pardon the pun, in the last few weeks with world events. It's like, what's the point now in expending any effort? And now is the point two. I don't know if it's as hard for you. It's hard for me to a certain extent. On the other hand, it's relieving. It's hard for me though to realize and accept that what I put my whole life into 35 years into didn't work, at least in the sense that we achieved a total change in consciousness. We've all planted a lot of seeds, but.
I think that the effect of what we do. I've given this speech quite a bit to people. We never know where those seeds will take root. Whether they take root tomorrow or whether they take root 5 years from now, none of us can predict that. That's why the Zeitgeist movement exists, really, as a consciousness shifting movement. Because we can talk about meetings and we can do all these things and maybe even have Occupy style events. But in the end, we don't know where it's going to shift. So I just keep going out there and doing what I can and try to inspire others to do it, as you do. But I try to limit expectation. I try to not torture myself by thinking that maybe even in my lifetime I'm going to see the type of shifts that are really required to get the human species on the right path.
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm kind of feeling also at a point where I'm due to sit down and just have a really good cry.
I can relate to that too.
I'm thinking about writing another song, because we carry this emotion, and you are my spiritual brother, and I know how hard this road is, and I've watched you walk it, and you have nothing but respect for me. But this takes an emotional toll, and it does. But it also takes a lot of heart, which is what we both have. We're down to 2 minutes before the end of the show. Peter, what's up with you next? What are you doing next? I'm going to write a song and work on my garden and try to write this book between me and spirit. What are you going to do?
That's great. Well, I'm resetting. I'm not doing any more lectures for a while. I have a new film I'm slowly trying to inch into. That should be great. I also have a show, as I mentioned. It's going to be kind of a web series initially. I'm going to try and get some larger interest through time. But once a month, I'm going to do this show called Culture in Decline. I refer to it as Carl Sagan meets George Carlin. And it should be fun. So I'm basically going to take your advice really to make fun of this, because if we can't make fun, we can't enjoy this slow grind on some twisted level, then we're just going to leave ourselves.
Yep.
We have to keep positive, and we have to realize that we make the best of it.
Well, I don't feel so alone now that I see how fully you're here and how much we see the same thing. You have no idea how important it is to meet somebody who you respect, who shares a viewpoint with you. It kind of makes you feel safe and that you're not crazy. But maybe we're both crazy, Peter.
Well, I definitely appreciate that, and I certainly identify with you on that level, too. And I encourage everyone out there that's banging their head against the system to take a deep breath and have some humor and to be a little existential every now and again. It doesn't hurt to detach from this. Look at it as a big comedic TV show, a little tragedy show, a little Shakespearean tragedy. And from there, you can find some resolve and then keep pushing forward. So I have lots of projects coming up. The Zeitgeist Media Festival is another one. I'll plug that real fast.
All right. We're out of time. Peter Joseph, thank you so much for coming back on the Lifeboat Hour. You're going to be back again. We'll just have a group therapy session together, and we can have a meeting and see who wants to join in. God bless you, my friend. This is Mike Rupert from the Lifeboat Hour on PRN-FM. We will be back with you next week, and it's going to get spicier from here on out. Love you, Peter. Take care.
Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it. You too.